Chapter 4. Long After Moonset. 1. He rode restlessly for nearly 2 hours back and forth along what she called the drop, never pushing Rusher above a trot, although what he wanted to do was gallop the big gelding under the stars until his own blood began to cool a little. It'll cool plenty if you draw attention to yourself, he thought, and likely you won't even have to cool it yourself. Fools are the only folk on the earth who can absolutely count on getting what they deserve. That old saying made him think of the scarred and bow-legged man who had been his life's greatest teacher, and he smiled. At last he turned his horse down the slope to the trickle of brook which ran there, and followed it a mile and a half upstream. Past several gathers of horse, they looked at Rusher with a kind of sleepy, wall-eyed surprise, to a grove of willows. From the hollow within, a horse whickered softly. Rusher whickered in return, stamping one hoof and nodding his head up and down. His rider ducked his own head as he passed through the willow fronds, and suddenly there was a narrow and inhuman white face hanging before him, its upper half all but swallowed by black, pupil-less eyes. He dipped for his guns, the third time tonight he'd done that, and for the third time there was nothing there. Not that it mattered. Already he recognized what was hanging before him on a string, that idiotic rook skull. The young man who was currently calling himself Arthur Heath had taken it off his saddle. It amused him to call the skull so perched their lookout. Ugly as an old gammer, but perfect cheap to feed. And hung it here as a prank greeting. Him and his jokes. Rusher's master batted it aside hard enough to break the string and send the skull flying into the dark. "Fie, Roland," said a voice from the shadows. It was reproachful, but there was laughter bubbling just beneath, as there always was. Cuthbert was his oldest friend. The marks of their first teeth had been embedded on many of the same toys, but Roland had in some ways never understood him. Nor was it just his laughter. On the long-ago day when Hax, the palace cook, was to be hung for a traitor on Gallows Hill, Cuthbert had been in an agony of terror and remorse. He told Roland he couldn't stay, couldn't watch. But in the end he had done both. Because neither the stupid jokes nor the easy surface emotions were the truth of Cuthbert Allgood. As Roland entered the hollow at the center of the grove, a dark shape stepped out from behind the tree where it had been keeping. Halfway across the clearing, it resolved itself into a tall, narrow-hipped boy who was barefooted below his jeans and bare-chested above them. In one hand he held an enormous antique revolver, a kind which was sometimes called a beer barrel because of the cylinder's size. "Fie!" Cuthbert repeated, as if he liked the sound of this word, not archaic, only in forgotten backwaters like Magus. "That's a fine way to treat the guard of the watch, smacking the poor thin-faced fellow halfway to the nearest mountain range. If I'd been wearing a gun, I likely would have blown it to smithereens and woken half the countryside." "I knew you wouldn't be going about strapped," Cuthbert answered mildly. "You're remarkably ill-looking, Roland, son of Stephen, but nobody's fool, even as you approach the ancient age of 15. I thought we agreed we'd use the names we're traveling under, even among ourselves." Cuthbert stuck out his leg, bare heel planted in the turf, and bowed, with his arms outstretched and his hands strenuously bent at the wrist, an inspired imitation of the sort of man for whom court has become career. He also looked remarkably like a heron standing in a marsh, and Roland snorted laughter in spite of himself. Then he touched the inside of his left wrist to his forehead to see if he had a fever. He felt feverish enough inside his head, gods knew, but the skin above his eyes felt cool. "I cry your pardon, gunslinger," Cuthbert said, his eyes and hands still turned humbly down. The smile on Roland's face died. "And don't call me that again, Cuthbert, please. Not here, not anywhere, not if you value me." Cuthbert dropped his pose at once and came quickly to where Roland sat his horse. He looked honestly humbled. "Roland, Will, I'm sorry." Roland clapped him on the shoulder. "No harm done. Just remember from here on out, Magus may be at the end of the world, but it still is the world. Where's Alain? Dick, do you mean?" "Where do you think?" Cuthbert pointed across the clearing to where a dark hulk was either snoring or slowly choking to death. That one, Cuthbert said, would sleep through an earthquake. But you heard me coming and woke. Yes, Cuthbert said. His eyes were on Roland's face, searching it with an intensity that made Roland feel a little uneasy. Did something happen to you? You look different. Do I? Yes. Excited. Aired out somehow. If he was going to tell Cuthbert about Susan, now was the time. He decided, without really thinking about it, most of his decisions, certainly the best of them, were made in this same way, not to tell. If he met her at Mayor's house, it would be the first time, as far as Cuthbert and Elaine knew as well. What harm in that? I've been properly aired, all right, he said, dismounting and bending to uncinch the girths of his saddle. I've seen some interesting things, too. Ah? Speak, companion of my bosom's dearest tenant. I'll wait until tomorrow, I think, when yon hibernating bear is finally awake. Then I only have to tell once. Besides, I'm tired. I'll share you one thing, though. There are too many horses in these parts, even for a barony renowned for its horseflesh. Too many by far. Before Cuthbert could ask any questions, Roland pulled the saddle from Rusher's back and set it down beside three small wicker cages which had been bound together with rawhide, making them into a carrier which could be secured to a horse's back. Inside, three pigeons with white rings around their necks cooed sleepily. One took his head out from beneath his wing, had a peek at Roland, and then tucked himself away again. "These fellows all right?" Roland asked. "Fine. Pecking and shitting happily in their straw. As far as they're concerned, they're on vacation." "What did you mean about tomorrow?" Roland said. And Cuthbert, seeing that there would be no more, only nodded and went to find his lean and bony lookout. 20 minutes later, Rusher unloaded and rubbed down and set to forage with Buckskin and Glue Boy. Cuthbert could not even name his horse as a normal person would. Roland lay on his back in his bedroll, looking up at the late stars overhead. Cuthbert had gone back to sleep as easily as he had awakened at the sound of Rusher's hoofs. But Roland had never felt less sleepy in his life. His mind turned back a month. To the whore's room, to his father sitting on the whore's bed and watching him dress. The words his father had spoken, "I have known for 2 years," had reverberated like a struck gong in Roland's head. He suspected they might continue to do so for the rest of his life. But his father had had much more to say about Martin, about Roland's mother, who was perhaps more sinned against than sinning, about harriers who called themselves patriots, and about John Farson, who had indeed been in Cressia, and who was gone from that place now, vanished, as he had a way of doing, like smoke in a high wind. Before leaving, he and his men had burned Indri, the barony seat, pretty much to the ground. The slaughter had been in the hundreds, and perhaps it was no surprise that Cressia had since repudiated the affiliation and spoken for the good man. The barony governor, the mayor of Indri, and the high sheriff had all ended the early summer day which concluded Farson's visit with their heads on the wall guarding the town's entrance. That was, Stephen Deschain had said, pretty persuasive politics. It was a game of castles, where both armies had come out from behind their hillocks and the final moves had commenced, Roland's father had said, and as was so often the case with popular revolutions, that game was apt to be over before many in the baronies of Midworld had begun to realize that John Farson was a serious threat. Or, if you were one of those who believed passionately in his vision of democracy and an end to what he called class slavery and ancient fairy tales, a serious agent of change. His father and his father's small quartet of gunslingers, Roland was amazed to learn, cared little about Farson in either light. They looked upon him as small cheese. Looked upon the affiliation itself as small cheese, come to that. "I'm going to send you away," Stephen had said, sitting there on the bed and looking somberly at his only son, the one who had lived. "There is no true safe place left in Midworld. But the barony of Magus on the clean sea is as close to true safety as any place may be these days, so it's there you'll go, along with at least two of your mates, Alan, I suppose, for one. Just not that laughing boy for the other, I beg of you. You'd be better off with a barking dog." Roland, who on any other day in his life would have been overjoyed at the prospect of seeing some of the wider world, had protested hotly. If the final battles against the good man were at hand, he wanted to fight them at his father's side. He was a gunslinger now, after all, if only apprentice, and... His father had shaken his head, slowly and emphatically. "No, Roland, you don't understand. You shall, however, as well as possible, you shall." Later, the two of them had walked the high battlements above Midworld's last living city, green and gorgeous Gilead in the morning sun, with its pennons flapping and the vendors in the streets of the old quarter and horses trotting on the bridal paths which radiated out from the palace standing at the heart of everything. His father had told him more, not everything, and he had understood more, far from everything, nor did his father understand everything. The Dark Tower had not been mentioned by either of them, but already it hung in Roland's mind, a possibility like a storm cloud far away on the horizon. Was the tower what all of this was really about? Not a jumped-up harrier with dreams of ruling Midworld, not the wizard who had enchanted his mother, not the glass ball which Stephen and his posse had hoped to find in Cressia, but the Dark Tower? He hadn't asked. He hadn't dared ask. Now he shifted in his bedroll and closed his eyes. He saw the girl's face at once. He felt her lips pressed firmly against his own again and smelled the scent of her skin. He was instantly hot from the top of his head to the base of his spine, cold from the base of his spine to the tips of his toes. Then he thought of the way her legs had flashed as she slid from Rusher's back, also the glimmer of the undergarments beneath her briefly raised dress, and his hot half and cold half changed places. The whore had taken his virginity but wouldn't kiss him, had turned her face aside when he tried to kiss her. She had allowed him to do whatever else he wanted, but not that. At the time he'd been bitterly disappointed. Now he was glad. The eye of his adolescent mind, both restless and clear, considered the braid which fell down her back to her waist, the soft dimples which had formed at the corners of her mouth when she smiled, the lilt of her voice, her old-fashioned way of saying I and nay, ye and yer and da. He thought of how her hands had felt on his shoulders as she stretched up to kiss him, and thought he would give everything he owned to feel her hands there again, so light and so firm, and her mouth on his. It was a mouth that knew only a little about kissing, he guessed, but that was a little more than he knew himself. "Be careful, Roland. Don't let your feeling for this girl tip anything over. She's not free anyway, she said as much. Not married, but spoken for in some other way." Roland was far from the relentless creature he would eventually become. But the seeds of that relentlessness were there, small, stony things that would in their time grow into trees with deep roots, and bitter fruit. Now one of these seeds cracked open and sent up its first sharp blade. What's been spoken for may be unspoken, and what's done may be undone. Nothing sure, but I want her. Yes, that was the one thing he did know, and he knew it as well as he knew the face of his father. He wanted her. Not as he had wanted the whore when she lay naked on her bed with her legs spread and her half-lidded eyes looking up at him, but in the way he wanted food when he was hungry or water when he was thirsty. In the way he supposed that he wanted to drag Martin's dusty body behind his horse down Gilead's high road in payment for what the wizard had done to his mother. He wanted her. He wanted the girl, Susan. Roland turned over on his other side, closed his eyes, and fell asleep. His rest was thin and lit by the crudely poetic dreams only adolescent boys have, dreams where sexual attraction and romantic love come together and resonate more powerfully than they ever will again. In these thirsty visions, Susan Delgado put her hands on Roland's shoulders over and over, kissed his mouth over and over, told him over and over to come to her for the first time, to be with her for the first time, to see her for the first time, to see her very well. 2. 5 miles or so from where Roland slept and dreamed his dreams, Susan Delgado lay in her bed and looked out her window and watched Old Star begin to grow pale with the approaching dawn. Sleep was no closer now than it had been when she lay down, and there was a throb between her legs where the old woman had touched her. It was distracting, but no longer unpleasant, because she now associated it with the boy she'd met on the road and impulsively kissed by starlight. Every time she shifted her legs, that throb flared into a brief, sweet ache. When she'd got home, Aunt Cord, who would have been in her own bed an hour before on any ordinary night, had been sitting in her rocking chair by the fireplace, dead and cold and swept clean of ashes at this time of year, with a lapful of lace that looked like wave froth against her dowdy black dress. She was edging it with a speed that seemed almost supernatural to Susan, and she hadn't looked up when the door opened and her niece came in on a swirl of breeze.
"I expected you an hour ago," Aunt Cord said,
and then, although she didn't sound it, "I was worried."
"Aye,"
Susan said, and said no more. She thought that on any other night she would have offered one of her fumbling excuses, which always sounded like a lie to her own ears. It was the effect Aunt Cord had had on her all her life. But this hadn't been an ordinary night. Never in her life had there been a night like this. She found she could not get Will Dearborn out of her mind. Aunt Cord had looked up then, her close-set, rather beady eyes sharp and inquisitive above her narrow blade of a nose. Some things hadn't changed since Susan had set out for the Coos. She had still been able to feel her aunt's eyes brushing across her face and down her body like little whisk brooms with sharp bristles.
"What took you so long?" Aunt Cord had asked. "Was there trouble?"
"No trouble," Susan had replied. But for a moment she thought of how the witch had stood beside her in the doorway, pulling her braid through the gnarled tube of one loosely clenched fist. She remembered wanting to go, and she remembered asking Rhea if their business was done.
"Mayhap there's one more little thing," the old woman had said, or so Susan thought.
But what had that one more little thing been? She couldn't remember. And really, what did it matter? She was shut of Rhea until her belly began to rise with Thorin's child. And if there could be no baby-making until reap night, she'd not be returning to the Coos until late winter at the soonest. An age. And it would be longer than that, were she slow to kindle.
"I walked slowly coming home, Aunt, that's all."
"Then why look ye so?"
Aunt Cord had asked, scant brows knitting toward the vertical line which creased her brow.
"How so?"
Susan had asked, taking off her apron and knotting the strings and hanging it on the hook just inside the kitchen door.
"Flushy, frothy, like milk fresh out of the cow."
She'd almost laughed. Aunt Cord, who knew as little about men as Susan did about the stars and planets, had struck it directly. Flushy and frothy was exactly how she felt.
"Only the night air, I suppose," she had said. "I saw a meteor, Aunt, and heard the thinny. The sound's strong tonight."
"Aye?"
her aunt asked without interest, then returned to the subject which did interest her.
"Did it hurt?"
"A little."
"Did you cry?"
Susan shook her head.
"Good. Better not. Always better. She likes it when they cry, I've heard. Now, Sue, did she give you something? Did the old pussy give you something?"
"Aye."
She reached into her pocket and brought out the paper with "Honest" written upon it. She held it out, and her aunt snatched it away with a greedy look. Cordelia had been quite the sugar plum over the last month or so, but now that she had what she wanted, and now that Susan had come too far and promised too much to have a change of heart, she'd reverted to the sour, supercilious, often suspicious woman Susan had grown up with.
the one who'd been driven into almost weekly bouts of rage by her phlegmatic life-goes-as-twill brother. In a way, it was a relief. It had been nerve-wracking to have Aunt Cord playing Sibylla Goodsprite day after day.
"Aye, aye, there's her mark, all right," her aunt had said, tracing her fingers over the bottom of the sheet. "A devil's hoof's what it means, some say, but what do we care, eh, Sue? Nasty, horrid creature that she is, she still made it possible for two women to get on in the world a little longer. And you'll only have to see her once more, probably around year's end, when you've caught proper."
"It will be later than that," Susan had told her. "I'm not to lie with him until the full of the demon moon, after the reaping fair and the bonfire."
Aunt Cord had stared, eyes wide, mouth open. "Said she so?"
"Are you calling me a liar, Auntie?" she had thought, with a sharpness that wasn't much like her. Usually her nature was more like her father's.
"Aye. But why? Why so long?"
Aunt Cord was obviously upset, obviously disappointed. There had so far been 8 pieces of silver and 4 of gold out of this. They were tucked up wherever it was that Aunt Cord squirreled her money away, and Susan suspected there was a fair amount of it, although Cordelia liked to plead poverty at every opportunity. And twice that much was still owed, or would be once the blood-stained sheet went to the mayor's house laundress. That same amount would be paid yet again when Rhea had confirmed the baby and the baby's honesty. A lot of money, all told. A great lot for a little place like this and little folk like them. And now to have the paying of it put back so far. Then came a sin Susan had prayed over, although without much enthusiasm, before getting into her bed. She had rather enjoyed the cheated, frustrated look on Aunt Cord's face, the look of the thwarted miser.
"Why so long?" she repeated. "I suppose you could go up to the Coos and ask her."
Cordelia Delgado's lips, thin to begin with, had pressed together so tightly they almost disappeared.
"Are you pert, missy? Are you pert with me?"
"No, I'm much too tired to be pert with anyone. I want to wash. I can still feel her hands on me, so I can. And go to bed."
"Then do so. Perhaps in the morning we can discuss this in more ladylike fashion. And we must go and see Hart, of course."
She folded the paper Rhea had given Susan, looking pleased at the prospect of visiting Hart Thorin, and moved her hand toward her dress pocket.
"No,"
Susan said, and her voice had been unusually sharp, enough so to freeze her aunt's hand in mid-air. Cordelia had looked at her, frankly startled. Susan had felt a little embarrassed by that look, but she hadn't dropped her eyes, and when she held out her own hand, it had been steady enough.
"I'm to have the keeping of that, Aunt." "Who tells you to speak so?"
Aunt Cord had asked, her voice almost whining with outrage. It was close to blasphemy, Susan supposed, but for a moment Aunt Cord's voice had reminded her of the sound the thinny made.
"Who tells you to speak so to the woman who raised a motherless girl, to the sister of that girl's poor dead father?"
"You know who," Susan said. She still held her hand out.
"I'm to keep it, and I'm to give it to Mayor Thorin. She said she didn't care what happened to it then. He could wipe his bum with it for all of her."
The flush which suffused her aunt's face at that had been very enjoyable.
"But until then, it was to be in my keeping." "I never heard of such a thing,"
Aunt Cordelia had huffed, but she had handed the grimy scrap of paper back.
"Given the keep of such an important document to a mere scrap of a girl!
Yet not too mere a scrap to be his jilly, am I? To lie under him and listen to his bones creak, and take his seed and mayhap bear his child." She dropped her eyes to her pocket as she put the paper away again, not wanting Aunt Cord to see the resentment in them.
"Go up,"
Aunt Cord had said, brushing the froth of lace off her lap and into her workbasket, where it lay in an unaccustomed tangle.
"And when you wash, do your mouth with a special care. Cleanse it of its impudence and disrespect toward those who have given up much for love of its owner."
Susan had gone silently, biting back a 1,000 retorts, mounting the stairs as she had so often, throbbing with a mixture of shame and resentment. And now here she was, in her bed and still awake, as the stars paled away and the first brighter shades began to color the sky. The events of the night just past slipped through her mind in a kind of fantastical blur, like shuffled playing cards.
and the one which turned up with the most persistence was the face of Will Dearborn. She thought of how that face could be hard at one moment and soften so unexpectedly at the next. And was it a handsome face? Aye, she thought so. For herself, she knew so. I've never asked a girl to ride out with me, or if she would accept a visit of me. I would ask you, Susan, daughter of Patrick.
Why now? Why should I meet him now, when no good can come of it?
If it's Kaa, it'll come like a wind, like a cyclone. She tossed from one side of the bed to the other, then at last rolled onto her back again. There would be no sleep for her in what remained of this night, she thought. She might as well walk out on the drop and watch the sun come up. Yet she continued to lie in bed, feeling somehow sick and well at the same time, looking into the shadows and listening to the first cries of the morning birds, thinking of how his mouth had felt against hers, the tender grain of it and the feeling of his teeth below his lips, the smell of his skin, the rough texture of his shirt under her palms. She now put those palms against the top of her shift and cupped her breasts with her fingers. The nipples were hard like little pebbles, and when she touched them the heat between her legs flared suddenly and urgently. She could sleep, she thought. She could if she took care of that heat, if she knew how. And she did. The old woman had shown her. Even a girl who's intact don't need to lack for a shiver now and then. Like a little bud of silk, so it is. Susan shifted in bed and slipped a hand deep beneath the sheet. She forced the old woman's bright eyes and hollow cheeks out of her mind. It wasn't hard to do at all once you set your mind to it, she discovered, and replaced it with the face of the boy with the big gelding and the silly flat-crowned hat. For a moment the vision of her mind became so clear and so sweet that it was real, and all the rest of her life only a drab dream. In this vision he kissed her over and over, their mouths widening, their tongues touching. What he breathed out, she breathed in. She burned. She burned in her bed like a torch. And when the sun finally came over the horizon some short time later, she lay deeply asleep, with a faint smile on her lips, and her unbraided hair lying across the side of her face and pillow, like loose gold. 3. In the last hour before dawn, the public room of the Traveler's Rest was as quiet as it ever became. The gaslights which turned the chandelier into a brilliant jewel until 2 o'clock or so on most nights were now turned down to guttering blue points, and the long, high room was shadowy and spectral. In one corner lay a jumble of kindling, the remains of a couple of chairs smashed in a fight over a watch-me game. The combatants were currently residing in the High Sheriff's drunk cell. In another corner was a fairly large puddle of congealing puke. On the raised platform at the east end of the room stood a battered piano. Propped against its bench was the ironwood club which belonged to Barky, the saloon's bouncer and all-around tough man. Barky himself, a naked mound of his scarred stomach rising above the waistband of his corduroy pants like a clot of bread dough, lay under the bench, snoring. In one hand he held a playing card, the deuce of diamonds. At the west end of the room were the card tables. 2 drunks lay with their heads on one of these, snoring and drooling on the green felt, their outstretched hands touching. Above them, on the wall, was a picture of Arthur, the great king of Eld, astride his white stallion, and a sign which read, in a curious mixture of high and low speech, "Argue not about the hand you are dealt in cards or life." Mounted behind the bar, which ran the length of the room, was a monstrous trophy, a 2-headed elk, with a rack of antlers like a forest grove, and 4 glaring eyes. This beast was known to local habitués of the Travelers as the Romp. None could have said why. Some wit had carefully drawn a pair of sow-titty condoms over the prongs of two of its antlers. Lying on the bar itself, and directly beneath the romp's disapproving gaze, was Petty the Trotter, one of the traveler's dancers and jilly girls. Although Petty's actual girlhood was well behind her now, and soon she would be reduced to doing her business on her knees behind the travelers rather than upstairs in one of the tiny cribs. Her plump legs were spread, one dangling over the bar on the inside, one on the outside, the filthy tangle of her skirt frothed up between. She breathed in long snores, occasionally twitching at the feet and fat fingers. The only other sounds were the hot summer wind outside and the soft, regular snap of cards being turned one by one. A small table stood by itself near the batwing doors which gave upon the Hambry High Street. It was here that Coral Thorin, owner of the Traveller's Rest and the mayor's sister, sat on the nights when she descended from her suite to be a part of the company. When she came down early, when there were still more steaks than whiskey being served across the old scratched bar, and went back up around the time that Sheb, the piano player, sat down and began to pound his hideous instrument. The mayor himself never came in at all, although it was well known that he owned at least a half-interest in the travelers. Clan Thorin enjoyed the money the place brought in. They just didn't enjoy the look of it after midnight, when the sawdust spread on the floor began to soak up the spilled beer and the spilled blood. Yet there was a hard streak in Coral, who had 20 years before been what was called a wild child. She was younger than her political brother, not so thin, and good-looking in a large-eyed, weasel-headed way. No one sat at her table during the saloon's operating hours. Barkey would have put a stop to anyone who tried, and double-quick. But operating hours were over now. The drunks mostly gone or passed out upstairs, Sheb curled up and fast asleep in the corner behind his piano. The soft-headed boy who cleaned the place had been gone since 2 o'clock or so, chased out by jeers and insults and a few flying beer glasses, as he always was. Roy de Pape, in particular, had no love in his heart for that particular lad. He would be back around 9 or so to begin readying the old party palace for another night of hilarity. But until then, the man sitting at Mistress Thorin's table had the place to himself. A game of patience was laid out before him, black on red, red on black, the partially formed square accord above all, just as it was in the affairs of men. In his left hand, the player held the remains of the deck. As he flipped the cards up, one by one, the tattoo on his right hand moved. It was disconcerting somehow, as if the coffin were breathing. The card player was an oldish fellow, not as thin as the mayor or his sister, but thin. His long white hair straggled down his back. He was deeply tanned except for his neck, where he always burned. The flesh hung there in scant wattles. He wore a mustache so long the ragged white ends hung nearly to his jaw. A sham gunslinger's mustache, many thought it. But no one used the word sham to Eldred Jonas's face. He wore a white silk shirt, and a black-handled revolver hung low on his hip. His large, red-rimmed eyes looked sad on first glance. A second, closer look showed them only to be watery. Of emotion, they were as dead as the eyes of the romp. He turned up the ace of wands. No place for it.
"Pa, you bugger,"
he said in an odd, reedy voice. It quavered as well, like the voice of a man on the verge of tears. It fit perfectly with his damp and red-rimmed eyes. He swept the cards together. Before he could reshuffle, a door opened and closed softly upstairs. Jonas put the cards aside and dropped his hand to the butt of his gun. Then, as he recognized the sound of Reynolds' boots coming along the gallery, he let go of the gun and drew his tobacco pouch from his belt instead. The hem of the cloak Reynolds always wore came into view, And then he was coming down the stairs, his face freshly washed and his curly red hair hanging about his ears. Vain of his looks was dear old Mr. Reynolds. And why not? He'd sent his cock on its exploring way up more damp and cozy cracks than Jonas had ever seen in his life, and Jonas was twice his age. At the bottom of the stairs, Reynolds walked along the bar, pausing to squeeze one of Patty's plump thighs, and then crossed to where Jonas sat with his makings and his deck of cards.
"Evening, Aldred. Morning, Clay."
Jonas opened the sack, took out a paper, and sprinkled tobacco into it. His voice shook, but his hands were steady.
"Like a smoke? I could do with one."
Reynolds pulled out a chair, turned it around, and sat with his forearms crossed on its back. When Jonas handed him the cigarette, Reynolds danced it along the backs of his fingers, an old gunslinger trick. The big coffin hunters were full of old gunslinger tricks.
"Where's Roy? With her nibs?"
They had been in Hambury a little over a month now, and in that time DePape had conceived a passion for a 15-year-old whore named Deborah. Her bow-legged, clumping walk and her way of squinting off into the distance led Jonas to suspect that she was just another cowgirl from a long line of them. But she had high-hat ways. It was Clay who had started calling the girl her nibs or her majesty, or sometimes, when drunk, Roy's coronation cunt. Reynolds now nodded.
"It's like he's drunk on her." "He'll be all right. He ain't throwing us over for some little snuggle bunny with pimples on her tits. Why, she's so ignorant she can't spell cat. Not so much as cat, no, I asked her."
Jonas made a second cigarette, drew a sulfur match from the sack, and popped it alight with his thumbnail. He lit Reynolds first, then his own. A small yellow cur came in under the batwing doors. The men watched it in silence, smoking. It crossed the room, first sniffed at the curdled vomit in the corner, then began to eat it. Its stub of a tail wagged back and forth as it dined. Reynolds nodded toward the admonition not to argue about the cards you were dealt.
"That mutt'd understand that, I'd say." "Not at all, not at all," Jonas demurred. "Just a dog is all he is, a spew-eatin' dog. I heard a horse 20 minutes ago, first on the come, then on the go. Would it have been one of our hired watchmen?" "You don't miss a trick, do you? Don't pay to. No, don't pay a bit. Was it?"
"Yep.
Fella who works for one of the small freeholders out along the east end of the drop. He seen him come in. 3. Young. Babbies."
Reynolds pronounced this last as they did in the northern baronies. "Babbies.
Nothing to worry of." Now, we don't know that," Jonas said, his quavering voice making him sound like a temporizing old man. "Young eyes see far, they say."
"Young eyes see what they're pointed at," Reynolds replied.
The dog trotted past him, licking its chops. Reynolds helped it on its way with a kick the cur was not quite quick enough to avoid. It scuttled back out under the bat wings, uttering little yike-yike sounds that made Barky snort thickly from his place of rest beneath the piano bench. His hand opened, and the playing card dropped out of it.
"Maybe so, maybe not," Jonas said. "In any case, they're affiliation brats, sons of big estates off in the green somewhere, if Reimer and that fool he works for have it straight. That means we'll be very, very careful. Walk easy, like on eggshells. Why, we've got 3 more months here, at least, and those young'uns may be here that whole time, counting this and counting that and putting it all down on paper. Folks counting things ain't good for us right now, not for men in the resupply business."
"Come on, it's make work, that's all. A slap on the wrist for getting in trouble. They're daddies,
no Farsons in charge of the whole southwest edge now and sitting on high ground. The brats may know the same, that playtime's pretty near over for the affiliation and all its pukesome royalty. Can't know, Clay. With folks like these, you can't know which way they'll jump. At the very least, they may try to do a half-decent job just to try and get on the good side of their parents again. We'll know better when we see 'em, but I tell you one thing. We can't just put guns to the backs of their heads and drop 'em like broke-leg hosses if they see the wrong thing. Their daddies might be mad at him alive, but I think they'd be very tender of him dead. That's just the way daddies are. We'll want to be trig, Clay. As trig as we can be.
Better leave DePape out of it, then.
Roy will be fine, Jonas said in his quavery voice.
He dropped the stub of his cigarette to the floor and crushed it under his boot heel. He looked up at the romp's glassy eyes and squinted as if calculating.
Tonight, your friend said? They arrive tonight, these brats?
Yep.
They'll be in to see Avery tomorrow, then, I reckon.
This was Herc Avery, High Sheriff of Magus and Chief Constable of Hambry, a large man who was as loose as a trundle of laundry.
"Reckon so," Clay Reynolds said, "to present their papers and all." "Yes, sir, yes, indeedy. How'd he do, and how'd he do, and how'd he do again?"
Reynolds said nothing. He often didn't understand Jonas, but he had been riding with him since the age of 15, and knew it was usually better not to ask for enlightenment. If you did, you were apt to end up listening to a cult Manny lecture about the other worlds the old buzzard had visited through what he called the special doors. As far as Reynolds was concerned, there were enough ordinary doors in the world to keep him busy.
"I'll speak to Reimer, and Reimer'll talk to the sheriff about where they should stay," Jonas said. "I think the bunkhouse at the old Bar K Ranch, you know where I mean?"
Reynolds did. In a barony like Magus, you got to know the few landmarks in a hurry. The Bar K was a deserted spread of land northwest of town, not too far from that weird, squalling canyon. They burned at the mouth of the canyon every fall, and once, 6 or 7 years ago, the wind had shifted and gone back wrong, and burned most of the Bar K to the ground, barns, stables, the home place. It had spared the bunkhouse, however, and that would be a good spot for 3 tenderfeet from the innards. It was away from the drop. It was also away from the oil patch.
"You like it, don't you?" Jonas asked, putting on a hick Hambry accent. "Ah, ye like it very much, I can see ye do, my cully. You know what they say in Cressia? If ye'd steal the silver from the dining room, first put the dog in the pantry."
Reynolds nodded. It was good advice.
"And those trucks, those what-do-you-call-ems, tankers?" "Fine where they are," Jonas said. "Not that we could move 'em now without attracting the wrong kind of attention, eh? You and Roy want to go out there and cover 'em with brush, lay it on nice and thick. Day after tomorrow you'll do it."
"And where will you be while we're flexing our muscles out at Sitco?"
"By daylight? Preparing for dinner at Mayor's house, you clod. The dinner Thorin will be giving to introduce his guests from the great world to the shit-picky society of the smaller one."
Jonas began making another cigarette. He gazed up at the romp rather than at what he was doing and still spilled barely a scrap of tobacco.
"A bath, a shave, a trim of these tangled old man's locks. I might even wax my mustache, Clay. What do you say to that?"
"Don't strain yourself, Eldred." Jonas laughed, the sound shrill enough to make Barky mutter and Petty stir uneasily on her makeshift bar-top bed.
"So Roy and I aren't invited to this fancy do?"
"You'll be invited, oh yes, you'll be invited very warmly," Jonas said, and handed Reynolds the fresh cigarette.
He began making another for himself.
"I'll offer your excuses. I'll do you boys proud. Count on me. Strong men may weep.
Also, we can spend the day out there in the dust and stink covering those hulks. You're too kind, Jonas."
"I'll be asking questions as well," Jonas said dreamily, "drifting here and there, looking spruce, smelling of bayberries, and asking my little questions. I've known folks in our line of trade who'll go to a fat, jolly fella to find out the gossip, a saloon keeper or a bartender, perhaps a livery stable owner, or one of the chubby fellas who always hangs about the jail or the courthouse with his thumbs tucked into his vest pockets. As for myself, Clay, I find that a woman's best, and the narrower the better, one with more nose than tits sticking off her. I look for one who don't paint her lips and keeps her hair scrooped back against her head."
"You have someone in mind?"
Yeah? Cordelia Delgado's her name.
Delgado?
You know the name. It's on the lips of everyone in this town, I reckon. Susan Delgado, our esteemed mayor's soon-to-be Jilly. Cordelia's her auntie. Now, here's a fact of human nature I've found. Folk are more apt to talk to someone like her who plays them close than they are to the local jolly types who'll buy you a drink. And that lady plays them close. I'm going to slip in next to her at that dinner, and I'm going to compliment her on the perfume I doubt like hell she'll be wearing, and I'm going to keep a wine glass full. Now, how sounds that for a plan?
A plan for what? That's what I want to know.
For the game of castles we may have to play, Jonas said, and all the lightness dropped out of his voice. We're to believe that these boys have been sent here more as a punishment than to do any real job of work. It sounds plausible, too. I've known rakes in my time, and it sounds plausible indeed. I believe it each day until about 3 in the morning, and then a little doubt sets in. And do you know what, Clay? Reynolds shook his head. I'm right to doubt. Just as I was right to go with Rhymer to old man Thorin and convince him that Farson's glass would be better with the witch woman for the nonce. She'll keep it in a place where a gunslinger couldn't find it, let alone a nosy lad who's yet to have his first piece of ass. These are strange times. A storm's coming. And when you know the wind is going to blow, it's best to keep your gear battened down.
He looked at the cigarette he had made. He had been dancing it along the backs of his knuckles, as Reynolds had done earlier. Jonas pushed back the fall of his hair and tucked the cigarette behind his ear.
"Well, I don't want to smoke," he said, standing up and stretching. His back made small crackling sounds. "I'm crazy to smoke at this hour of the morning. Too many cigarettes apt to keep an old man like me awake."
He walked toward the stairs, squeezing Petty's bare leg as he went by, also as Reynolds had done. At the foot of the stairs, he looked back.
"I don't want to kill them. Things are delicate enough without that. I'll smell quite a little wrong on them and not lift a finger, no, not a single finger, my hand. But I'd like to make them clear on their place in the great scheme of things."
"Give them a sore paw." Jonas brightened.
"Yes, sir, partner. Maybe a sore paw's just what I'd like to give 'em. Make 'em think twice about tangling with the big coffin hunters later on, when it matters. Make them swing wide around us when they see us in their road. Yes, sir, that's something to think about. It really is."
He started up the stairs, chuckling a little, his limp quite pronounced. It got worse late at night. It was a limp Roland's old teacher, Court, might have recognized. For Court had seen the blow which caused it. Court's own father had dealt it with an ironwood club, breaking Eldred Jonas's leg in the yard behind the great hall of Gilead, before taking the boy's weapon and sending him west, gunless, into exile. Eventually, the man the boy had become had found a gun, of course. The exiles always did, if they looked hard enough. That such guns could never be quite the same as the big ones with the sandalwood grips might haunt them for the rest of their lives. But those who needed guns could still find them, even in this world. Reynolds watched until he was gone, then took his seat at Coral Thorin's desk, shuffled the cards, and continued the game which Jonas had left half-finished. Outside, the sun was coming up.